Last week was the first full week after the holidays. Hopefully your transition back to work wasn't too rough. Thanks for listening to Behind the Headlines. As usual, I'm your host, Katie O'Connell. If you're a movie buff like me, then you're anxious to know who will be nominated for an Academy Award. And you're also in luck. Those nominations come out on Thursday. Resident movie expert Chris Foran will join the show later to let you know where you can see some of the potential nominees on the silver screen. Before we get to that, here's a word of warning about our first segment. We're starting off today's show with a segment about the Stephen Avery case and Making a Murderer, the documentary it inspired. This segment may be upsetting to some. Stephen Avery became one of Wisconsin's most famous faces in 2003. Convicted of sexual assault in Manitowoc in 1985, Avery was exonerated and released from prison in 2003 after DNA evidence cleared him of the crime. Just 2 years later, Avery was arrested again, this time for the murder of Teresa Halbach, a 25-year-old photographer who was last seen on Halloween. Avery was eventually found guilty of the murder and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. After Avery exhausted his appeals, the case seemed to be over. But in December, Netflix released a documentary, Making a Murderer, that brought Avery back into the limelight. The documentary, made by two filmmakers who followed the case for decades, has drawn national and international attention. Journal Sentinel reporter Tom Kircher covered Avery's exoneration in 2003, as well as his arrest in 2005 and subsequent trial and conviction. Reporter Chelsea Lewis talks with Kircher about the case and the documentary.
The crime occurred in Manitowoc County. That's where the jurors were from, which is normal. But the trial itself was held in Calumet County, next door, so to speak, partly because of the fact that when Stephen Avery had been freed from prison, he sued Manitowoc County. He wanted to get $36 million for being wrongly convicted. And so when he became a suspect in the murder, Manitowoc County decided, gee, we better not be involved in this investigation. We want to avoid a conflict of interest considering the wrongful conviction lawsuit. So let's have Calumet County do the investigation. But as people well know, if they watch the Netflix series, the Manitowoc Sheriff's Department did not stay away. They were involved in the investigation, and it was Manitowoc deputies who found some of the key evidence in the case.
Yeah, you know, when I was watching, that was kind of one thing that struck me, that even though the trial was held in Calumet County, the jury was still from Manitowoc. Do you remember at the time what the reasoning, why the defense wanted that or allowed that?
There were motions to change a venue, as I say, to move it completely, not only hold it in a different county, but choose jurors from a different county. But it was decided to remain there in Manitowoc, or at least using Manitowoc residents. Another reason, though, that it was held in Calumet County, the trial, was for logistics. They had a newer, larger courthouse. They knew there would be a lot of media crush, a lot of people there. So that was another reason it was held next door, so to speak.
Okay, so now we fast forward to December, just this past December. A documentary comes out, Making a Murderer. This past week, you watched it and kind of live tweeted a little bit your thoughts and reactions as you watched it. What were some of your thoughts as you were watching the series? You know, you have a really unique perspective in that you were there during the trial. You probably have one of the largest perspectives on it because you've seen both of that. So what were some of your thoughts?
You know, on a personal level, I didn't want to watch it. I had spent years writing about not only Stephen Avery, but then writing about Teresa Halbach's murder and then writing about the trial. And, you know, it was the details of her murder were grisly. I won't go into all of them, but, you know, for example, her body had been incinerated. And so to go through all of that, not only the stress of a trial, but those details, I just didn't want to spend, frankly, 10 hours of my free time watching something that I knew would bring up a lot of unpleasantness. So, you know, a lot of people said, you got to watch it. I just didn't want to do it on a personal level. But my editors came to me and said, we want you to watch this and write an analysis. And that really helped a lot. It put me back into the work mindset. I wasn't doing this on my own time and, you know, going through some difficulty watching it. This was, hey, let's watch this. trying to answer the question of, you know, what is highlighted in film versus what was highlighted in the trial, and how do the two compare?
So what are some things that you noticed that were perhaps highlighted in the documentary that weren't in the trial or vice versa?
Maybe a different way of answering that would be to point out for people some of the key evidence that led the jury to find him guilty. You know, the Making a Murderer film focuses on the fact that the Manitowoc deputies who weren't supposed to be involved in the investigation were, may have planted a key in Avery's trailer, may have planted his blood in the murder victim's car, that sort of thing. Those were strong elements of the film. In contrast, it's important to remember a couple things. One of them is that the story is told from the perspective of Avery, Avery's family, Avery's lawyers, which doesn't discount the questions that are raised, but people who are watching the film and trying to evaluate it need to remember that, look, it is told from the defense point of view. You know, secondly, you know, while the focus of the film is on the possibility that Manitowoc sheriff's deputies planted evidence to frame Avery, you know, that was brought out in the trial, but so were lots of other things that were maybe touched on in the film but maybe deserve a little more attention. And that was, ironically, DNA evidence. You know, DNA evidence is what freed Avery from prison in the wrongful conviction case. Obviously powerful stuff, and it was just as powerful, I think you could say, in convicting him. The jury was told that the murder victim, Teresa Halbach, that her DNA was found in blood in her car. Her DNA was found in the burned remains of her body outside of Avery's trailer. Her DNA was found on a spent bullet found in Avery's garage. And Avery's DNA, excuse me, was found not only inside but outside of Halbach's car. And Avery's DNA was found on the key to her car. So, again, it's important to keep in perspective that the film raises lots of good questions to consider, but the jury obviously was persuaded to some large extent by the DNA as well.
So the documentary focuses on Stephen Avery and his trial, and a couple of the episodes do touch on Brendan Dassey, his nephew, who at the time was 16, was also eventually convicted of murder. I think you tweeted something like you wished you had covered that trial. Why do you say that?
Yeah, just in terms of the tweeting first, I had a suggestion of a friend who I was complaining to initially about having to watch the film. Why don't you live tweet it? And I thought, well, I've done a little bit of that, you know, on different stories, but not much. So I didn't even mention to the editors I was planning to do that because I didn't know would I want to do it at all. Would I tweet once every, you know, 10 minutes or every 18 hours? So I just started doing it, but it really picked up momentum. I found there were a lot of things that I could, from my experience covering the case, could comment on as I watched, and then it ended up drawing hundreds and hundreds of new followers, and those people would comment. And so it became, you know, something of a shared experience watching it. And you're correct. One of the things I said was that looking back, I regret that I spent that time covering the Avery trial but not the trial of his nephew, Brendan Dassey, who was 16 at the time. You know, Brendan Dassey was put on trial as well for the murder after Avery, and he was also found guilty. The reason I say I wished I had covered it was because of the film. Maybe the most disturbing parts of the film show how this 16-year-old, learning disabled Brendan Dassey is interrogated and, I think fair to say, led into a confession. So sometimes being questioned without his lawyer being present, sometimes being pressured to confess by the investigator for that defense attorney. You know, I can't really make a judgment or analysis of how the film treats the Dassey case since I didn't cover the Dassey case. But strictly from watching the film, there's lots of questions about whether the 16-year-old kid had adequate legal representation initially, that initial lawyer was replaced before the trial, and also whether maybe there needs to be some larger questions asked about how teenage suspects are interrogated.
So the series has kind of prompted some strong reactions. You know, there was a petition to free Stephen Avery or pardon him. There's some anger. Is that kind of emotion different from what the emotion was like while the trial was going on. What was kind of public perception or emotion like back in 2007 as compared to now?
Sounds cliche, but night and day. You know, when the jury came back and found Avery guilty, certainly there were people who disagreed with that verdict, who believed the theory that he was framed by the police or believed that somebody else, you know, was involved or committed the murder. But there was not anywhere close to this sort of public outcry in Wisconsin, much less on a national and international level like there is now. So the film, no question about it, whether you like it or don't like it, you know, has had a huge impact, I think, in some good ways in the sense of a lot of people watching this probably don't know very much about how the criminal justice system works. So if it's raising questions, raising awareness about how cases are investigated, how suspects are treated, that sort of thing, that's good. Again, though, people need to keep in mind this is told from the defense perspective. So if you're going to draw conclusions about the entire American justice system based on this case, first of all, remember it's one case. Second of all, remember that, you know, the film is told from the largely from the point of view of the defense.
For Kircher's original coverage of the 2007 Stephen Avery trial and updates on the case and the documentary, visit jsonline.com/Avery. You can also follow Kircher on Twitter. His handle is Kircher News, that's spelled K-E-R-T-S-C-H-E-R. Award season has arrived. The Golden Globes are today, and Academy Award nominations come out on Thursday. Which movies are most likely to be nominated, and where can you see them? Here's reporter Mary Louise Schumacher and editor Chris Foran with the scoop.
This is Mary Louise Schumacher, and I'm here with Chris Foran, one of our entertainment editors who is responsible for many of our entertainment sections, including the Green Sheet and the Weekend section. And he has just written a big story on, you know, how to get to see all the movies that are potentially going to be nominated for Oscars this year. So first of all, Chris, just let me know, how do you even know what's potentially going to be nominated for Oscars at this point? This is a pretty comprehensive list you've given us.
Well, the truth is I don't know, but I know people who know. We comb through a lot of the experts who are people who actually, believe it or not, their job is to track what movies are likely contenders. And I kind of extrapolated from four or five different sources like that and kind of what I know from the history of this kind of thing. And put together a list of 30 movies that are likely to be in the mix when they announce the Oscar nominations next Thursday, January 14th. Of those 30, people in Milwaukee can see 20 of them now. A lot of them in theaters, some of them streaming on iTunes or Amazon, a couple on Netflix, a bunch more on DVD. The Martian is on DVD, in theaters, and is streaming. So lots of options for you.
If readers are interested in seeing these movies before the Oscars, is there any particular strategy that you would recommend? Like, should we go and try to see just the nominations for Best Picture?
The bigger contenders in this year's Oscars will probably be around for a while. A good example is Spotlight, which is right now is only in one theater. My guess is it'll do well at the Golden Globes this Sunday and get a bunch of nominations next Thursday. And voila, it'll be in about 10 theaters next week. Some movies are already past the curve. Mad Max Fury Road, which was a pretty well-received action movie that came out last summer, directed by George Miller, part of the post-apocalyptic series of movies that he's made, is expected by a couple of experts that I've read to be the movie with the most nominations this year. It's been on DVD for 2 months already. So you can pick your spots. I mean, there are a lot of ways to see this stuff. You could, you know, if you like seeing performances by strong women, there's about five or six movies that you can see right now. Brooklyn with Saoirse Ronan and Carol with Kate Blanchett and Rooney Mara are both in theaters. And they'll probably, as I said, they'll probably be in more theaters. There'll be a lot to choose from. This year, maybe more than previous years, there's a big mix of small arty stuff, big arty stuff, and blockbustery stuff. So there's an outside chance that Star Wars The Force Awakens will get a nomination for Best Picture, so see what you want first and okay. Work from there.
And of the 30 films on your list, are there any that are particularly hard to find that are maybe in just one or two theaters?
Right now, as I mentioned, Spotlight is only in one theater, and Brooklyn is only in one theater. My hunch would be that they will get into more theaters as the award season picks up. Some movies have not come yet. The story that we have doesn't even mention the foreign language films and documentaries, some of which have come and gone and some of which are not coming till later. A couple of movies that are in the mix and might likely will be nominated are coming later this month. Animalisa is a quirky animated movie by the quirky Charlie Kaufman, opens January 15th in Milwaukee. The Lady in the Van with Dame Maggie Smith, everyone's favorite dowager, is supposed to open in Milwaukee on January 29th. She's considered a possibility for best actors or best supporting, depending on how they put her in there. But one of the heavy contenders for, or big contenders for, best actress is Charlotte Rampling in 45 Years. And as of now, I have not heard that it's going to have a Milwaukee date at all. It may still. This stuff is a lot more improvisational than it used to be. Yeah. The movies we'll find out about movies opening a couple of days before they open sometimes.
Are there any films on this list that you personally feel like you want to get out and see before the Oscars?
I try to see as many movies as I can, and having said that, I have not seen a good number of the films on there. I'd like to see The Hateful Eight. I think it's going to get some nominations. I haven't figured out how to block a half a day's time to watch it. I probably should see The Danish Girl. I haven't seen that. I should see Carol. I haven't seen that. After that, it's going to be just filling in the gaps. The Big Short is another one that's considered a possible Best Picture nominee, and that looks really good. I have not seen that yet either, so I have miles to go.
Now, that story came out in Friday's edition of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. If you didn't get a chance to read it then, you can find it online at tapmilwaukee.com. Last week, reporter Jason Stein walked us through some of the upcoming local elections. But what will some of the nationwide elections mean for Wisconsin? In the ever-changing world of politics, how will Wisconsin representatives fare? Wisconsin Bureau Chief Craig Gilbert weighed in during this week's JS on Politics show.
Hi, I'm Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and here are a few things I'll be watching for in 2016. First, will the Republican presidential race drag on long enough for the Wisconsin primary to matter? Wisconsin's primary isn't until April 5th, after 32 other states vote. If it's still a real race by then, that's good for the voters of Wisconsin. They'll have a say in the Republican nomination. But it may not be good for the Republican Party, since a protracted race gives the party's nominee less time to rev up his general election campaign. Second, will the nominee be Donald Trump, which could make Wisconsin unwinnable for Republicans and could be deeply damaging to Republican Senator Ron Johnson's reelection bid? All the polling so far suggests Trump has less appeal in Wisconsin than he does nationally. Third, will Paul Ryan's speakership run into trouble in Wisconsin from unruly conservative colleagues in Washington, or back home in the form of a primary challenge? It's been smooth sailing so far. How long can that last? Fourth, can Russ Feingold do something no one has done in decades, which is win a Senate rematch he lost 6 years earlier? And can Ron Johnson do something no Republican has done in more than 35 years, which is win a Senate election in Wisconsin in a presidential year? Wisconsin's a great illustration of how quickly things change in politics. Take four big-name Republicans in this state. In a few short years, Ron Johnson went from a political nobody to chairman of the U.S. Senate Homeland Security Committee, and now there's a chance he could be returning to private life not long after he left it. Scott Walker went from embattled first-year governor to national conservative hero to presidential flop. Reince Priebus became the GOP's longest-serving national chairman ever, saw his party dominate congressional, legislative, and gubernatorial elections, but could retire without ever achieving his biggest dream, a GOP White House. And finally, Paul Ryan has gone from budget chairman to vice presidential loser to Ways and Means chairman to House Speaker in just a few years. If their history's any guide, there's a lot more drama and change to come in 2016.
Our political team also discussed Governor Scott Walker's approval rating, among other things. If you're interested in hearing that segment, you can subscribe to JS on Politics on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. A full replay of the show is also available at jsonline.com/politics. With the Green Bay Packers set to play the Washington Redskins in the NFL playoffs Sunday,
Packers fans are wondering what's up with Aaron Rodgers and the passing game. And are Rodgers and coach Mike McCarthy on the same page? Journal Sentinel beat reporter Tom Silverstein and former Packers All-Pro safety Leroy Butler talked about the relationship between quarterback and coach in their weekly video series on JS Online.
And then you go to, really, you look to see what's the relationship between Rodgers and McCarthy that, you know, I mean, yeah, this is something that's kind of been the elephant in the room.
Yeah.
And, you know, we haven't really heard either sides talk about having to, you know, have a meeting of the minds or some kind of a come to Jesus meeting or what.
Yeah.
Behind the scenes, all you can judge is what you see in these games. And to me, it doesn't look great, does it?
In a marriage, somebody has to be the husband, somebody has to be the wife. Okay?
Oh, you're going to get in trouble for that.
But you have to get along.
Mm-hmm.
It's a marriage. It's a marriage.
Right.
It is a marriage. You know, I'm going to bring home the bacon. You're going to help with the kids. And we love each other unconditionally. That's the only way you can play this game.
Uh-huh.
It has to be unconditional love with the coaches and the players. Now, I'm going to say that half the people watching this probably don't like their boss, okay?
Right.
Probably.
Uh-huh.
But you still got to work.
Yeah.
Aaron has to understand that to run this family, you need McCarthy. McCarthy knows to run this family, you need Aaron Rodgers. Because I couldn't see a scenario where either one of them would leave. So you got to bring the family back to where it's a marriage. It's to death do us part.
Right.
That's the only way you're going to win this game. That's why you won two MVPs and scored 30 points a game. And you consider to be one of the top quarterbacks ever under McCarthy. We tried. He tried to put it under Tom Clemens. Mm-hmm. He tried it. Which I didn't agree with, but hey, listen, you guys handle it. I'm going to manage the whole team.
Right.
Didn't work.
No.
So, and that's the reason why I think we won in the 90s, Tom. We just had a bunch of kids running around in the house. No parents.
Right.
You bring the parents in there, you restore order. And now people start to understand Reggie was the leader, okay? And then Brett and Mike Holmgren, they respected each other.
Yeah, yeah. Now, that's the question I was going to ask you, is if they had stayed together as long as Rodgers and McCarthy, would they be at this same stage where Brett would be potentially not on the same page with Mike, that they had just tired of each other, or, you know, would that have happened?
See, I think, I don't think you ever get tired of Brett Favre because he adjusts. Brett Favre really adjusts. He adjusted McCarthy in 2007 and played a certain type of a way.
Right.
So it's on record. I think what kept Holmgren fun, because he did give Brett some rope in the offense.
Yeah.
But if you're going to put in 15-hour days, then we'll listen to what you got to say.
Yeah.
But if you're just going to come home, practice, and go home, then just follow my lead. They had some dust-ups.
Yeah.
But they really respected each other.
Yeah, I think Favre knew that Holmgren was the best thing for him.
Absolutely.
Holmgren knew that Favre was the best thing.
Yes, because who's going to cover for me when I throw three or four or five picks? The head coach.
Yeah.
The head coach, it's on me. That was my bad play call. It wasn't Brett.
Right.
Guys value that. But when Aaron says it's not the play calling, and the head coach said, I'm going to take over the play calling.
Right.
Then you got, there's a disconnect there. And I think that's the therapy of it, the sports psychology part of it, to say, listen, it's not who's the most macho guy. It's about doing it together. And that's the only way. If you, it's a different voice, then, okay, it's going to be some differences. Because I think this is the fourth consecutive week that he's going to call plays. And Mike's philosophy is a little bit different from Tom Clemens.
A little bit. But, you know, McCarthy, and this is something that I keep going around in my head, is that McCarthy said yesterday that he changed the play calling not because of the actual plays that were being called, because the process of game planning was getting out of the realm that he had created and was not, he wanted to get back to the process. Yeah. I'm the king of reading between lines. I could be totally
wrong. You're the king of making stuff up.
But I think maybe he gave too much latitude to his quarterback and said, you know, I'm backing out of this. You know, our relationship's, you know.
So he created this Frankenstein.
Right. He said,
okay. Frankenstein still, Tom, protected his creator. He protected him. He went back into the fire to get him.
Yeah.
They got to run through walls for each other. I don't necessarily need to see this, but I was hoping to get a joint press conference and say, guys, the air is, we're good.
Yeah.
Let's get on to some football. Right. But you can obviously see during timeouts, they don't talk very much. There's no dialogue. There's no strategy. You know what I'm saying? So each guy wants to do it his way. But ultimately, it's the head coach. Because they get rid of more head coaches than Hall of Fame quarterbacks.
Yeah.
So you got to understand that the coach is the coach. He's going to give you the material. This guy puts in 15, 16-hour days away from his family. Yeah. The least you can do is buy into the program. And now the other players will see that, then everybody will elevate their game. And I think it'll make the team better. Okay. If not, we're looking at another one and done.
Yeah. And a lot of upheaval in the offseason, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't know how they repair that.
You can hear more from Tom and Leroy on the Packers at jsonline.com/LeroyButler. Well, that does it for today's show. Thanks so much for listening. Once again, if you're interested in subscribing to this podcast, you can find it on both iTunes and Stitcher Radio. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great week and join us next week for more.